A summary of current American trade policy, if I might. Two steps forward, at least one step back. The week that was in this economy straight ahead from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 17th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Step forward number one, just to continue with a theme here. It was the official word this morning that President Trump is going to hold off on big car tariffs for 6 months, at any rate. Step forward number two is that the U.S., Mexico, and Canada have come to terms on the president's steel and aluminum tariffs. They will be lifted, and Canada and Mexico will work on getting the new NAFTA agreement approved. It still does have to go to the U.S. Congress. Remember that. The step back was a report from CNBC this afternoon that Chinese trade talks have, and this is their word, stalled. So we are going to take those steps and we're going to run with them, as it were. Kate Davidson's at the Wall Street Journal. Dion Rabowan is at Axios. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
So, Kate, what do you think? Two steps forward, at least one step back. Is that a fair approximation?
I think so, Kai. We at the Journal have been reporting that the talks are stalled. You know, we heard earlier this week Treasury Secretary Mnuchin saying, yeah, we really intend to go back to Beijing soon to resume negotiations. Other people close to the secretary have been saying the same thing. Then we heard yesterday the Chinese finance minister saying, I know nothing about this. He said, I'm not sure if there are plans. We haven't heard anything. So, that suggests that they're either in the dark or there's not a whole lot of action behind the scenes. And meanwhile, you know, we're hearing from the agriculture sector a lot of concern. Yeah. You know, we hear Deere, the farming machinery manufacturer, lowering their profit outlook today. Right. Saying, you know, farmers are buying fewer machines. They're being hurt by lower overseas purchases of corn and soybeans because of the tariffs. So that's, concern growing from that group.
Dion, ought we just assume that we're in this now specifically with China for the long haul? There are no signs, as Kate was saying, that negotiations are going to start and that they'll be fruitful.
Yeah, no signs. And actually, you know, if you want to characterize this about steps, I think we might have taken a couple steps forward, but we moonwalked all the way back to the other side of the stage when it comes to progress. Look, this U.S.-China trade war, China is our number one trade partner, and we've really engaged in what looks to be a long-term conflict. The term Cold War has started to be thrown around,
and a lot of
fund managers, financial analysts are really sitting here looking at, okay, what are the effects, the long-term effects of this whole globalization theme that's been in place in the market for about 20, 30 years now being rolled back? And I was talking to UBS strategists the other day, and they said, you know, it's interesting because globalization on the way up is like an escalator, but on the way down, it's like an elevator shaft.
So, Kate, look, here's the deal, though, right? I mean, we're bandying about big numbers, right? 25% tariffs on $200 billion worth of stuff. The White House is thinking of $300 billion more. And yet, there has been limited, at best, real consumer impact. I mean, Larry Kudlow's phrase for this, the president's chief economic advisor, is the impact has been de minimis.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's certainly true. I think that if you were to ask economists who study this for a long time, is that there often appears to be short term gain, but it's often at the expense of others in the economy. And over the long term, tariffs just are not good for the economy. They divert resources away from more efficient producers to less efficient ones. They can raise the cost of parts and materials eventually, which would, you know, raise the price of goods for consumers. And they tend to burden lower income households. So, we've heard Fed officials say this. We've heard other trade experts say it, that over the long run, yes, there are certainly people who are harmed by globalization and by other previous trade policies. But tariffs are not really the way to go about solving this issue.
Dion, what do you make of the White House's contention that that President Trump and by extension, the United States are in this trade war in a better position than President Xi and the Chinese economy?
Ooh. Yeah, that's a tough one because on the one hand, it is true that definitely the U.S. economy is stronger. It doesn't rely as much on imports. We are a much more closed economy than China, even though they are shifting in that direction where the U.S. gets a lot more of our GDP from services than we do from exports, manufacturing. But also, you've got these folks, and we talked about it a little bit earlier, you know, pressure from the manufacturing sector, farmers. You've got these groups like Tariffs Hurt the Heartland. and National Retail Federation that are really pushing back on President Trump. And the big question that we're going to find the answer to if these tariffs stay in place is, how much do firms actually have pricing power? Can companies raise prices and continue to see customers coming through the doors? Or is the American populace right now not in a position to pay anymore, and you're going to start seeing a real decline in some of these sales if they try to pass on the tariffs? That's a big thing that the Fed's been trying to figure out, and that a lot of economists have. And it looks like we might just find out.
Kate, with the caveat that the stock market is not the economy, it is, however, you know, economy adjacent, right? What do you make of the argument that you have started to see now, that what's happening is that the stock market is basically letting the president not have to deal with real pressure on these negotiations, that it goes down and then the president says something nice and traders go, oh, look, everything's spiffy, everything's fine, and we end up for the day?
Buy the dips.
Right. I think that that's becoming the new normal, right?
Yeah.
I think that it's a little bit of a chicken and egg situation. You know, this stock market, right, here's something from the president. I think, like, I guess the bar is pretty low here, right? There's a strong signal from someone in the administration, right? Things go up. The Chinese respond. They go down. I guess I think that he's kind of taking the response to his, you know, to his tweets as affirmation that, hey, everyone's happy that things are going well. And, so I do think there's something to that idea that you floated, Kai. Oh. And I'm not sure what's going to break that cycle,
right?
Yeah,
one never is. Yeah. Let me just very quickly hit on the way out, stay with you, and talk about the Congressional Budget Office. Alice Rivlin, the founding director, died this week, and there's a new person coming in. Tell us quickly who he is and then the short-term future of the CBO in terms of the politicization of this economy.
Sure. Well, Phil Swagel is going to be named the new CBO director. He's someone who had served on the CEA during the Bush administration. He was also a Bush Treasury official in the years leading up to the financial crisis. He was a big player in the attempts to sort of pull the economy back from the brink in 2008, 2009. He was an aide to Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson. But I think the key thing is he's very widely respected by folks on economists and lawmakers on both sides of the aisle. So this was a pick that was roundly praised. I think people are really happy to see him move in there. That means, of course, that Keith Hall, the previous director, is on his way out. And he faced a lot of blowback from Republicans during his time leading CBO when they were scoring these Obamacare repeal bills. There was a lot of contentious debate over that, a lot of attacks from the White House. So I think that there's some confidence that Phil is going to come in and sort of keep he actually said to me yesterday, you know, I'm keeping Alice Rivlin in my mind. I'm mindful of the tone that she set and the tradition that she had, and that's what I want to follow. So I think that's sending a strong signal that the CBO will remain nonpartisan and to the extent that it can, you know, try to ignore the political pressure that's been getting in recent years.
Kate Davidson at the Wall Street Journal, Dion Rabowan at Axios. Thanks, you two.
Thanks for having me.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street this Friday, a little slide into the close after that CNBC report on the China talks I mentioned. Details, numbers, you know the drill. Much as there is no shortage of economic data out there, so too there is no shortage of coverage of economic data here, because you got to know what's going on, right? But what to do when, as of late, the data does not tell a consistent story? For instance, jobless claims hit new lows this week. That's great. But there were downbeat retail spending numbers as well. Not so great. And then just this morning, consumer sentiment hit its highest level in 15 years. So, yay. But what gives? We asked Marketplace's Justin Ho to explain the contradictions.
You're not crazy if trying to make sense of this stuff makes your head hurt.
It's a general thing that humans do to get their hands around big, complex sets of information. We put a story to it.
George Perks at Bespoke Investment Group says a lot of times the story doesn't make any sense.
You're not always going to see exactly the same read on a given month from two different data sources.
For one, month-to-month data just isn't that reliable. Political headlines can shift, there can be weather problems. But Mark Lucchini at Janney Montgomery Scott says, don't forget, these reports are often revised the next month.
When the new report comes out, perhaps the number in the new report not only looks better, but there was a revision upward to the previous numbers.
That's why most economists say they prefer looking at long-term trends rather than monthly figures.
You know, when I used to work on Wall Street, we would always joke that, you know, wouldn't it be great if they just got rid of the monthly data and only put out data on a quarterly basis?
That's Drew Mattis at MetLife. He says there's another problem. The data we collect is a little old-fashioned. Think about it. Industrial production numbers, durable goods orders, inventories.
Most of our data collection is geared towards manufacturing, and we've turned into a service sector economy.
Mattis says the labor market is a much better measure of how the economy's doing. And lately, the labor market's been pretty strong, a factor that's propped up consumer sentiment. Another one, even though we always say the stock market isn't the economy, George Perks at Bespoke Investment Group says it has been a pretty positive influence.
When the stock market's performing well, as it has, you know, in Q1 and most of Q2 this year, then consumers are generally going to feel pretty positive about things.
Perks says as long as markets don't tank or something big shocks the entire economy, retail spending should pick up again soon. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Today's corporate news comes to us from the I don't feel like leaving the office or getting up off the couch economy. Amazon has bought a chunk of a company called Deliveroo. That's one of Europe's big food delivery companies. The Bring Me My Food segment of this economy is booming. Grubhub, Postmates, Uber Eats as well, handling the order and delivery of restaurant meals to people at home or at work, even a park, if that happens to be your thing. Marketplace's Eric Barris reports that while that does bring new business for restaurants, it makes extra work for them too and sometimes changes their business models.
At BRGR, or Burger, restaurants in Pittsburgh, manager Cassandra Scribner says the delivery services that bring wings and fried pickles to customers are
super great for the business. It brings in a lot of revenue for a lot of people who possibly would not want to be going out, essentially.
Delivery through those apps represents a third of the business at the restaurant's 6 locations. But those orders require some planning. Christopher Muller is a hospitality professor at Boston University.
The highest quality is in that eat-in moment when it comes out of the oven or out of the kitchen right to the table.
So at BRGR, burgers are undercooked, so they arrive at the right temperature. Soggy salad, not so much when all the dressing comes on the side. Muller says preparing and packaging meals differently can be a burden. Restaurants have to sometimes add extra staff. And the payoff? Not really there.
It's a plague on the business. Third-party delivery companies take anywhere from 20 to 30% of the revenue.
Still, this is a growing industry, says Hannah Spencer, a food service analyst with Mintel. Most orders through apps like DoorDash and Grubhub are made by urban millennials. And
they are ordering very frequently, so they are very valuable customers.
So some restaurants have designated pickup windows for those delivery apps. Chipotle even has a dedicated food prep line for delivery orders. Larger businesses can afford to do that or work out exclusive deals with a third-party operator like the one McDonald's has with Uber Eats, says Alex Suskind with Cornell's Institute for Food and Beverage Management. Not so easy for smaller restaurants who, he says, are operating at a loss.
To say, oh, well, you know, I'll make it up in volume, you know, zero times zero is zero. You're not going to make up a loss in volume.
But he says as competition among the apps heats up, costs will go down and restaurants could start to see some profit from those orders. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
What follows, I will warn you, is not for the technologically faint of heart. But do you suppose it's possible that the reason your phone seems to know more about you than you think it should, and we've all had that feeling, right? Do you suppose it's possible that maybe your phone is eavesdropping on you, not just when you're on a call, but all the time? If the answer is no, then how do you explain social media all of a sudden pushing something to you that maybe you've mentioned but not actually searched for, Marketplace's Jack Stewart did an admittedly unscientific experiment.
A couple of months ago, I was at a conference chatting with a group that included Betsy Cooper, director of the Aspen Institute's Tech Policy Hub.
You and I were sitting next to each other.
At some point during the day, I was showing her a picture on my Instagram, and we saw an ad that I'd never noticed before for a cybersecurity degree at UC Berkeley.
Well, my last job was working at UC Berkeley running a cybersecurity
really
center.
And it prompted that question, which you've probably asked yourself.
What could be the explanation for why you were suddenly getting cybersecurity Berkeley degrees than our conversation? In other words, was your phone listening to you?
In trying to answer that, we went down a wormhole. Betsy did an experiment, coming up with a couple of phrases that she has never typed into a search engine and saying them twice a day for a week near her phone.
These are the first times I've ever said these phrases out loud. So first, oh my God, I'm pregnant. I can't believe I'm pregnant. I am not pregnant.
Okay.
I checked with my husband to make sure he was okay with me doing this first. And then the second one is, I need to go to the hairdresser for a blowout. My curly hair really needs to be straight. I have straight hair.
Oh, that's a good one. Okay. So while Betsy's doing that, I checked in with some technology companies. They say yes, they do use microphones to listen for wake words like Alexa or Hey Google. Sorry if I've just triggered yours. But they say they don't monitor conversations. So I called Leslie John at Harvard Business School. She studies adverts, targeting, and consumer behavior, and she says technology companies don't need to listen to our conversations because we give away so much other information.
There are so many ways of capturing data. If you ask an advertising executive, I think that they would even be hard-pressed to enumerate all the ways that information can be gleaned from you.
There's our online friends, our purchase history, location, race, income bracket, age, education. They're all used to build an eerily accurate profile of us. Researchers have even been able to predict depression or PTSD by analyzing people's social media posts, sometimes many months before a clinical diagnosis. There is another explanation for why we see ads for something we've just been talking about. It's the frequency illusion. When we notice one of a thing, we suddenly start seeing that thing everywhere.
It seems like it's reading your mind when actually it's just a coincidence.
Maybe those ads were always there, but before you just scroll past without noticing. With all that in mind, I decided to do a version of Betsy's experiment myself. I also came up with a couple of phrases that I had never searched for.
Ugh, I really need to get a new couch.
I should really get a new
I
couch.
I think that I should get a new couch.
You know what? I really
Man,
need
I need a vacation.
And the results were frustratingly inconclusive. My ads didn't change, but Betsy Cooper, who spent a week faking pregnancy and wanting a hair appointment, did notice something.
I definitely got advertisements for diapers and hair care products, a couple of each. So it's a situation where we need to continue to investigate what permissions we're giving apps and how they're using those permissions.
And at the end of this process, she's left with an uneasy feeling about her phone. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace. Coming up.
Well, it was a little store, but it had everything.
A local supermarket gone, but not quite forgotten. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's down 98 points this Friday, 0.3%, 25,764. The NASDAQ dipped 81 points, about 1%, 78.16. The S&P 500 off 16 points, 0.5%, 28.59. For the week, the Dow gave back 0.6%, the NASDAQ down 1.2%, the S&P 500 shed 0.7%. Sensitive to the trade war, company Deere plunged 7.6%. Today, the heavy equipment maker reported lower quarterly profits than expected, as Kate mentioned. Pinterest is out with its first quarterly report since going public in April. The bottom line, a $41 million loss. Pinterest shares off 13.4%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, it's Molly Wood here, and you gotta listen to this week's Make Me Smart. It's all about climate adaptation. The idea that climate change is here and not in some far-off future, and so we have to start living with and adapting to the realities of it while also trying to fight it. So what does that all cost?
The operation and maintenance costs of all the things you've already decided to do that the current economy's already doing, those have just gone up. So you're playing more defense, and that leaves you with fewer resources to move forward and innovate.
Make Me Smart. Find us wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. In case you missed the sad news this morning, Grumpy Cat is dead. The grumpy-looking cat that spawned one of the best-known memes out there passed away from complications from a urinary tract infection at the age of 7. Some days, her owners wrote on Instagram, are grumpier than others. Grumpy Cat was an empire. She had an agent, merchandise, even a movie. And as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports, that is getting harder for a meme to do.
Tartar Sauce was born in Arizona back in 2012. She had a permanent frown due to feline dwarfism, and when a photo was posted of her on Reddit, Grumpy Cat, the star, was born.
She definitely struck a chord.
Christina Hanganu-Bresch is associate professor at the University of the Sciences.
She had this physical appearance of disaffection, of, you know, that we felt instantly bonded to her. And I'm thinking that she was free to express a negative emotion that we are not usually free to share.
Within a year, Grumpy Cat had a book and was on the cover of New York Magazine. She had licensing deals and royalties, eventually a movie. Grumpy Cat's fame came at a time when the internet was perhaps a little less saturated. Michael Soha is a senior lecturer at the University of New Hampshire.
I think there was a lot more positive excitement and almost giddiness around social media, this thing that we could share.
Soha says it'd be harder for one specific meme to get that same level of recognition today.
There just is a lot more culture happening today online, and I think it's a little bit less novel.
Memes are also harder to monetize today.
They've become very, very ephemeral.
Kate McKean is vice president at the Howard Morheim Literary Agency.
Memes can last 24 hours or a week and a half, and that's the life of that meme.
So by the time a brand has geared up to profit off of a meme these days, the meme's done. Back then, memes stuck around longer. Plus, Grumpy Cat was an actual cat who could make real appearances. McKean says she straddled the line between meme and influencer early on.
Influencers have kind of taken spaces that memes used to monetize and have changed the game.
Grumpy Cat's owners haven't said how much wealth she brought in during her 7 years. But after a lawsuit, a coffee company that had used the cat's image for marketing without permission had to award Grumpy Cat's owners $710,000. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Consumers in this economy can be interesting. We are price sensitive, but brand loyal. We like new options, but always come back to the familiar. And that love of what we know can really linger. Consider the supermarket. Any Wegmans devotees out there? Trader Joe's aficionados? Or from history, how about the A&P? In the upper Midwest, as Marketplace's Renata Sago reports, people still pine 30 years on for a chain called Red Owl.
Red Owl, red as in the color and owl as in the bird, was started by investors linked to General Mills in 1922. Back then, it sold groceries, dry goods, and coal. Its original slogan was, "Be wise, burn Red Owl coal." Tiny Stewart, Minnesota had one.
Well, it was a little store, but it had everything.
That's 34-year-old Jim Pesek of Stewart. We're standing outside the old Red Owl, the one he went to as a child.
Oh, we could pop up here. He had a comic book rack. I'd always, you know, get comic books, too.
Pesek and some other local history buffs bought the old Red Owl building back in 2013 for $1,000. They're raising money to turn part of it into a Red Owl museum. He's got a storage space down the street full of products he's collected from old employees and eBay.
Well, you got your Red Owl Honey Graham crackers, Red Owl pudding, Red Owl coffee, Red Owl brand pop, all stuff we want to display in the museum.
A local businessman named William Sundy opened Stewart's Red Owl franchise in 1939 with a $600 loan and cash he got from selling an old car, a pair of hip boots, and a gun. Stewart's Red Owl was one of more than 400 that were operating before the chain shut down. Stores positioned themselves as guardians of low-cost food, as you can hear in this radio spot from the bicentennial year of 1976, featuring a Johnny Cash imitator.
Just like the redcoats, inflation came. Everybody said it's too tough to tame. Red Owl folks don't think that's right. They're rebels and they've just begun to fight.
Red Owl stores featured distinctive logos. The final version was a bright red owl head with giant black eyes. The stores made a mark on Minnesota culture. In the opening sequence to the classic Mary Tyler Moore TV show, there's old Mary tossing some meat into her cart at a Red Owl, looking a little unhappy with the price. Minnesota filmmakers Joel and Ethan Cohn included scenes of Red Owl in their work a couple of times. Red Owl once dominated with more than 50% of the Twin Cities grocery market, so there's still a lot of people around who work there. In a suburb of Minneapolis, former Red Owl cashiers, produce managers, accountants get together over lunch at least once a month to reminisce.
I met up with them at one of their outings. A few were in Red Owl shirts or hats. Some brought collectibles like old Red Owl coupon books and recipe cards. Carol Dunsmore worked at a Red Owl for 15 years. She remembers all the social gatherings.
At least once a month, we'd go to a restaurant, we'd go to a play, we'd go tour a museum or something like that. We went to places that most of us would never, ever go to on our own, and it was so much fun.
Back in Stuart, Minnesota, Pesek says his group has raised about $4,000 to open its museum, selling Red Owl t-shirts mostly. They figure they need another $12,000 to fix up the building and bring their old Red Owl back to life. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today on the theory that some of you will be at a college graduation this weekend or sometime soon. This is from Glassdoor, a list of the highest paying entry-level jobs for the class of 2019. Data scientist gets you a median annual base salary of $95,000. A software engineer is worth $90,000. Product managers are third at $89,000. Got to go to fourth on the list before you get to entry-level investment banking, $85,000 as a base. So there is that. Also, an update to the final from yesterday, the Change.org petition to make HBO reshoot all of season 8 of Game of Thrones. 873,837 people as of this writing have now signed it. Me? I'm still Team Sansa, I gotta tell you. Boy, look at the time we got to go. Let us just say on Wall Street today, down day, down week. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will see you again on Monday. All right? This is APM.